in 2001, Rhadipithecus ramidus cadaba, dated at between 5.2 million and 5.8 million years old, and Ororin tugenensis, thought to be 6 million years old, making it the oldest hominid yet found, but only for a brief while. In the summer of 2002, a French team working in the Jurab Desert of Chad, an area that had never before yielded ancient bones, found a hominid almost 7 million years old, which they labelled Sahelanthropus chadensis. Some critics believe that it was not human, but an early ape, and therefore should be called Sahelpithecus. All these were early creatures, and quite primitive, but they walked upright, and they were doing so far earlier than previously thought. Bipedalism is a demanding and risky strategy. It means refashioning the pelvis into a full, load-bearing instrument. To preserve the required strength, the birth canal must be comparatively narrow. This has two very significant immediate consequences, and one longer-term one. First, it means a lot of pain for any birthing mother, and a greatly increased danger of fatality to mother and baby both. Moreover, to get the baby's head through such a tight space, it must be born while its brain is still small, and while the baby, therefore, is still helpless. This means long-term infant care, which in turn implies solid male-female bonding. All this is problematic enough when you are the intellectual master of the planet, but when you are a small, vulnerable Australopithecine with a brain about the size of an orange, the risk must have been enormous. Absolute brain size does not tell you everything, or possibly sometimes even much. Elephants and whales both have brains larger than ours, but you wouldn't have much trouble outwitting them in contract negotiations. It is relative size that matters, a point that is often overlooked. As Gould notes, A. africanus had a brain of only 450 cubic centimetres, smaller than that of a gorilla, but a typical africanus male weighed less than 100 pounds and a female much less still, whereas gorillas can easily top out at 600 pounds. So why did Lucy and her kind come down from the trees and out of the forests? Probably they had no choice.
This book is continued on Disc 15. Disc 15.
So why did Lucy and her kind come down from the trees and out of the forests? Probably they had no choice. The slow rise of the Isthmus of Panama had cut the flow of waters from the Pacific into the Atlantic, diverting warming currents away from the Arctic and leading to the onset of an exceedingly sharp ice age in northern latitudes. In Africa, this would have produced seasonal drying and cooling, gradually turning jungle into savanna. It was not so much that Lucy and her like left the forests, John Gribbon has written, but that the forests left them. But stepping out onto the open savanna also clearly left the early hominids much more exposed. An upright hominid could see better, but could also be seen better. Even now, as a species, we are almost preposterously vulnerable in the wild. Nearly every large animal you can care to name is stronger, faster, and toothier than us. Faced with attack, modern humans have only two advantages. We have a good brain with which we can devise strategies, and we have hands with which we can fling or brandish hurtful objects. We are the only creature that can harm at a distance. We can thus afford to be physically vulnerable. All the elements would appear to have been in place for the rapid evolution of a potent brain. And yet that seems not to have happened. For over 3 million years, Lucy and her fellow Australopithecines scarcely changed at all. Their brain didn't grow, and there is no sign that they used even the simplest tools. What is stranger still is that we now know that for about 1 million years they lived alongside other early hominids who did use tools, yet the Australopithecines never took advantage of this useful technology that was all around them. At one point, between 3 and 2 million years ago, it appears there may have been as many as 6 hominid types coexisting in Africa. Only one, however, was fated to last, Homo, which emerged from the mists beginning about 2 million years ago. No one knows quite what the relationship was between Australopithecines and Homo, but what is known is that they coexisted for something over a million years before all the Australopithecines, robust and gracile alike, vanished mysteriously, and possibly abruptly over a million years ago. No one knows why they disappeared. Perhaps, suggests Matt Ridley, we ate them. Conventionally, the Homo line begins with Homo habilis, a creature about whom we know almost nothing, and concludes with us. Homo sapiens, literally man the thinker. In between, and depending on which opinions you value, there have been half a dozen other Homo species. Homo ergaster, Homo neanderthalensis, Homo rudolfensis, Homo heidelbergensis, Homo erectus, and Homo antecessor. Homo habilis, handyman, was named by Louis Leakey and colleagues in 1964, and was so called because it was the first hominid to use tools, albeit very simple ones. It was a fairly primitive creature, much more chimpanzee than human, but its brain was about 50% larger than that of Lucy in gross terms, and not much less large proportionally, so it was the Einstein of its day. No persuasive reason has ever been advanced for why hominid brains suddenly began to grow 2 million years ago. For a long time it was assumed that big brains and upright walking were directly related, that the movement out of the forests necessitated cunning new strategies that fed off of or promoted braininess. So it was something of a surprise, after the repeated discoveries of so many bipedal dullards, to realize that there was no apparent connection between them at all. There is simply no compelling reason we know of to explain why human brains got large, says Tattersall. Huge brains are demanding organs. They make up only 2% of the body's mass, but devour 20% of its energy. They are also comparatively picky in what they use as fuel. If you never ate another morsel of fat, your brain would not complain because it won't touch the stuff. It wants glucose instead, and lots of it, even if it means short-changing other organs. As Guy Brown notes, the body is in constant danger of being depleted by a greedy brain, but cannot afford to let the brain go hungry, as that would rapidly lead to death. A big brain needs more food, and more food means increased risk. Tattersall thinks the rise of a big brain may simply have been an evolutionary accident. He believes, with Stephen Jay Gould, that if you replayed the tape of life, even if you ran it back only a relatively short way to the dawn of hominids, the chances are quite unlikely that modern humans, or anything like them, would be here now. One of the hardest ideas for humans to accept, he says, is that we are not the culmination of anything. There is nothing inevitable about our being here. It is part of our vanity as humans that we tend to think of evolution as a process that, in effect, was programmed to produce us. Even anthropologists tended to think this way right up until the 1970s. Indeed, as recently as 1991, in the popular textbook The Stages of Evolution, C. Loring Brace stuck doggedly to the linear concept, acknowledging just one evolutionary dead end, the robust Australopithecines. Everything else represented a straightforward progression, each species of hominid carrying the baton of development so far, then handing it on to a younger, fresher runner. Now, however, it seems certain that many of these early forms followed side trails that didn't come to anything. Luckily for us, one did. A group of tool users, which seemed to arise from out of nowhere and overlapped with a shadowy and much disputed Homo habilis. This is Homo erectus, the species discovered by Eugène Dubois in Java in 1891. Depending on which sources you consult, it existed from about 1.8 million years ago to possibly as recently as 20,000 or so years ago. According to the Java Man authors, Homo erectus is the dividing line. Everything that came before him was ape-like in character. Everything that came after was human-like. Homo erectus was the first to hunt, the first to use fire, the first to fashion complex tools, the first to leave evidence of campsites, the first to look after the weak and frail. Compared with all that had gone before, Homo erectus was extremely human in form as well as behavior, its members long-limbed and lean, very strong, much stronger than modern humans, and with the drive and intelligence to spread successfully over huge areas. To other hominids, Homo erectus must have seemed terrifyingly powerful, fleet, and gifted. Erectus was the velociraptor of its day, according to Alan Walker of Penn State University, and one of the world's leading authorities. If you were to look one in the eyes, it might appear superficially to be human. But you wouldn't connect. You'd be prey. According to Walker, it had the body of an adult human, but the brain of a baby. Although Erectus had been known about for almost a century, it was known only from scattered fragments, not enough to come even close to making one full skeleton. So it wasn't until an extraordinary discovery in Africa in the 1980s that its importance, or at the very least possible importance, as a precursor species for modern humans, was fully appreciated. The remote valley of Lake Turkana, formerly Lake Rudolph, in Kenya, is now one of the world's most productive sites for early human remains, but for a very long time no one had thought to look there. It was only because Richard Leakey was on a flight that was diverted over the valley that he realized it might be more promising than had been thought. A team was dispatched to investigate, but at first found nothing. Then late one afternoon, Kamoya Kimeu, Leakey's most renowned fossil hunter, found a small piece of hominid brow on a hill well away from the lake. Such a sight was unlikely to yield much, but they dug anyway out of respect for Kimeo's instincts, and to their astonishment found a nearly complete Homo erectus skeleton. It was from a boy aged between about 9 and 12 who had died 1.54 million years ago. The skeleton had an entirely modern body structure, says Tattersall, in a way that was without precedent. The Turkana boy was very emphatically one of us. Also found at Lake Turkana by Kimeo was KNM-ER1808, a female 1.7 million years old, which gave scientists their first clue that Homo erectus was more interesting and complex than previously thought. The woman's bones were deformed and covered in coarse growths, the result of an agonizing condition called hypervitaminosis A, which can come only from eating the liver of a carnivore. This told us, first of all, that Homo erectus was eating meat. Even more surprising was that the amount of growth showed that she had lived weeks or even months with the disease. Someone had looked after her. It was the first sign of tenderness in hominid evolution. It was also discovered that Homo erectus skulls contained, or in the view of some possibly contained, a Broca's area, a region of the frontal lobe of the brain associated with speech. Chimps don't have such a feature. Alan Walker thinks the spinal canal didn't have the size and complexity to enable speech, that they probably would have communicated about as well as modern chimps. Others, notably Richard Leakey, are convinced they could speak. For a time, it appears, Homo erectus was the only hominid species on Earth. It was hugely adventurous and spread across the globe with what seems to have been breathtaking rapidity. The fossil evidence, if taken literally, suggests that some members of the species reached Java at about the same time as, or even slightly before, they left Africa. This has led some hopeful scientists to suggest that perhaps modern people arose not in Africa after all, but in Asia, which would be remarkable, not to say miraculous, as no possible precursor species have ever been found anywhere outside Africa. The Asian hominids would have had to appear, as it were, spontaneously. And anyway, an Asian beginning would merely reverse the problem of their spread. You would still have to explain how the Java people then got to Africa so quickly. There are several more plausible, alternative explanations for how Homo erectus managed to turn up in Asia so soon after its first appearance in Africa. First, a lot of plus or minusing goes into the dating of early human remains. If the actual age of the African bones is at the higher end of the range of estimates, or the Javan ones at the lower end, or both, then there is plenty of time for African erects to find their way to Asia. It is also entirely possible that older erectus bones await discovery in Africa. In addition, the Javan dates could be wrong altogether. Now for the doubts. Some authorities don't believe that the Turkana finds are Homo erectus at all. The snag, ironically, was that although the Turkana skeletons were admirably extensive, all other erectus fossils are inconclusively fragmentary. As Tattersall and Jeffrey Schwartz note in Extinct Humans, most of the Turkana skeleton couldn't be compared with anything else closely related to it because the comparable parts weren't known. The Turkana skeletons, they say, look nothing like any Asian Homo erectus and would never have been considered the same species except that they were contemporaries. Some authorities insist on calling the Turkana specimens, and any others from the same period, Homo ergaster. Tattersall and Schwartz don't believe that goes nearly far enough. They believe it was ergaster, or a reasonably close relative, that spread to Asia from Africa, evolving into Homo erectus, and then died out. What is certain is that some time, well over a million years ago, some new, comparatively modern upright beings left Africa and boldly spread out across much of the globe. They possibly did so quite rapidly, increasing their range by as much as 25 miles a year on average, all while dealing with mountain ranges, rivers, deserts, and other impediments, and adapting to differences in climate and food sources. A particular mystery is how they passed along the west side of the Red Sea, an area of famously punishing aridity now, but even drier in the past. It is a curious irony that the conditions that prompted them to leave Africa would have made it much more difficult to do so, yet somehow they managed to find their way around every barrier and to thrive in the lands beyond. And that, I'm afraid, is where all agreement ends. What happened next in the history of human development is a matter of long and rancorous debate, as we shall see in the next chapter. But it is worth remembering, before we move on, that all of these evolutionary jostlings over 5 million years, from distant, puzzled Australopithecine to fully modern human, produced a creature that is still 98.4% genetically indistinguishable from the modern chimpanzee. There is more difference between a zebra and a horse, or between a dolphin and a porpoise, than there is between you and the furry creatures your distant ancestors left behind when they set out to take over the world. 29. The Restless Ape. Sometime about 1.5 million years ago, some forgotten genius of the hominid world did an unexpected thing. He, or very possibly she, took one stone and carefully used it to shape another. The result was a simple, teardrop-shaped hand axe, but it was the world's first piece of advanced technology. It was so superior to existing tools that soon others were following the inventor's lead and making hand axes of their own. Eventually, whole societies existed that seemed to do little else. They made them in the thousands, says Ian Tattersall. There are some places in Africa where you literally can't move without stepping on them. It's strange because they're quite intensive objects to make. It was as if they made them for the sheer pleasure of it. From a shelf in his sunny workroom, Tattersall took down an enormous cast, perhaps 1.5 feet long and 8 inches wide at its widest point, and handed it to me. It was shaped like a spearhead, but one the size of a stepping stone. As a fiberglass cast, it weighed only a few ounces, but the original, which was found in Tanzania, weighed 25 pounds. It was completely useless as a tool, Tattersall said. It would have taken 2 people to lift it adequately, and even then it would have been exhausting to try to pound anything with it. What was it used for, then? Tattersall gave a genial shrug, pleased at the mystery of it. No idea. It must have had some symbolic importance, but we can only guess what. The axes became known as Acheulean tools, after Saint-Acheul, a suburb of Amiens in northern France, where the first examples were found in the 19th century. And contrast with the older, simpler tools known as Olduan, originally found at Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania. In older textbooks, Olduan tools are usually shown as blunt, rounded, hand-sized stones. In fact, paleoanthropologists now tend to believe that the tool part of Olduan rocks were the pieces flaked off these larger stones, which could then be used for cutting. Now here's the mystery. When early modern humans, the ones who would eventually become us, started to move out of Africa something over 100,000 years ago, Acheulean tools were the technology of choice. These early Homo sapiens loved their Acheulean tools too. They carried them vast distances. Sometimes they even took unshaped rocks with them to make into tools later on. They were, in a word, devoted to the technology. But although Acheulean tools have been found throughout Africa, Europe, and Western and Central Asia, they have almost never been found in the Far East. This is deeply puzzling. In the 1940s, a Harvard paleontologist named Hallam Movius drew something called the Movius line, dividing the side with Acheulean tools from the one without. The line runs in a southeasterly direction across Europe and the Middle East to the vicinity of modern-day Calcutta and Bangladesh. Beyond the Movius line, across the whole of Southeast Asia and into China, only the older, simpler Alderwan tools have been found. We know that Homo sapiens went far beyond this point, so why would they carry an advanced and treasured stone technology to the edge of the Far East and then just abandon it? That troubled me for a long time, recalls Alan Thorne of the Australian National University in Canberra. The whole of modern anthropology was built round the idea that humans came out of Africa in two waves, the first wave of Homo erectus, which became Java man and Peking man and the like, and a later, more advanced wave of Homo sapiens, which displaced the first lot. Yet to accept that, you must believe that Homo sapiens got so far with their more modern technology and then, for whatever reason, gave it up. It was all very puzzling, to say the least. As it turned out, there would be a great deal else to be puzzled about, and one of the most puzzling findings of all would come from Thorne's own part of the world in the outback of Australia. In 1968, a geologist named Jim Bowler was poking around on a long dry lake bed called Mungo in a parched and lonely corner of western New South Wales when something very unexpected caught his eye. Sticking out of a crescent-shaped sand ridge of a type known as a lunette were some human bones. At the time, it was believed that humans had been in Australia for no more than 8,000 years, but Mungo had been dry for 12,000 years. So what was anyone doing in such an inhospitable place? The answer, provided by carbon dating, was that the bone's owner had lived there when Lake Mungo was a much more agreeable habitat, a dozen miles long, full of water and fish, fringed by pleasant groves of casuarina trees. To everyone's astonishment, the bones turned out to be 23,000 years old. Other bones found nearby were dated to as much as 60,000 years. This was unexpected, to the point of seeming practically impossible. At no time since hominids first arose on Earth has Australia not been an island. Any human beings who arrived there must have come by sea in large enough numbers to start a breeding population, after crossing 60 miles or more of open water without having any way of knowing that a convenient landfall awaited them. Having landed, the Mungo people had then found their way more than 2,000 miles inland from Australia's north coast, the presumed point of entry, which suggests, according to a report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that people may have first arrived substantially earlier than 60,000 years ago. How they got there, and why they came, are questions that can't be answered. According to most anthropology texts, there's no evidence that people could even speak 60,000 years ago, much less engage in the sorts of cooperative efforts necessary to build ocean-worthy craft and colonize island continents. There's just a whole lot we don't know about the movements of people before recorded history, Alan Thorne told me when I met him in Canberra. Do you know that when 19th-century anthropologists first got to Papua New Guinea, they found people in the highlands of the interior, in some of the most inaccessible terrain on Earth, growing sweet potatoes? Sweet potatoes are native to South America, so how did they get to Papua New Guinea? We don't know. Don't have the faintest idea. But what is certain is that people have been moving around with considerable assuredness for longer than traditionally thought, and almost certainly sharing genes as well as information. The problem, as ever, is the fossil record. Very few parts of the world are even vaguely amenable to the long-term preservation of human remains, says Thorne, a sharp-eyed man with a white goatee and an intent but friendly manner. If it weren't for a few productive areas like Haydar and Olduvai in East Africa, we'd know frighteningly little. And when you look elsewhere, often we do know frighteningly little. the whole of India has yielded just one ancient human fossil from about 300,000 years ago. Between Iraq and Vietnam, that's a distance of some 5,000 kilometres, there have been just two, the one in India and a Neanderthal in Uzbekistan. He grinned. That's not a whole hell of a lot to work with. You're left with a position that you've got a few productive areas for human fossils, like the Great Rift Valley in Africa and Mungo here in Australia, and very little in between. It's not surprising that paleontologists have trouble connecting the dots. The traditional theory to explain human movements, and the one still accepted by the majority of people in the field, is that humans dispersed across Eurasia in two waves. The first wave consisted of Homo erectus, who left Africa remarkably quickly, almost as soon as they emerged as a species, beginning nearly 2 million years ago. Over time, as they settled in different regions, these early erects further evolved into distinctive types, into Java man and Peking man in Asia, and Homo heidelbergensis, and finally Homo neanderthalensis in Europe. Then, something over 100,000 years ago, a smarter, lither species of creature, the ancestors of every one of us alive today, arose on the African plains and began radiating outward in a second wave. Wherever they went, according to this theory, these new Homo sapiens displaced their duller, less adept predecessors. Quite how they did this has always been a matter of disputation. No signs of slaughter have ever been found, so most authorities believe the newer hominids simply outcompeted the older ones, though other factors may also have contributed. Perhaps we gave them smallpox, suggests Tattersall. There's no real way of telling. The one certainty is that we are here now, and they aren't. These first modern humans are surprisingly shadowy. We know less about ourselves, curiously enough, than about almost any other line of hominids. It is odd indeed, as Tattersall notes, that the most recent major event in human evolution, the emergence of our own species, is perhaps the most obscure of all. Nobody can even quite agree where truly modern humans first appear in the fossil record. Many books place their debut at about 120,000 years ago in the form of remains found at the Klazes River mouth in South Africa. But not everyone accepts that these were fully modern people. Tattersall and Schwartz maintain that whether any or all of them actually represent our species still awaits definitive clarification. The first undisputed appearance of Homo sapiens is in the eastern Mediterranean, around modern-day Israel, where they begin to show up about 100,000 years ago, but even there they are described, by Trinkaus and Shipman, as odd, difficult to classify, and poorly known. Neanderthals were already well established in the region, and had a type of toolkit known as Musterian, which the modern humans evidently found worthy enough to borrow. No Neanderthal remains have ever been found in North Africa, but their toolkits turn up all over the place. Somebody must have taken them there. Modern humans are the only candidate. It is also known that Neanderthals and modern humans coexisted in some fashion for tens of thousands of years in the Middle East. We don't know if they time-shared the same space or actually lived side by side, Tattersall says. But the moderns continued happily to use Neanderthal tools, hardly convincing evidence of overwhelming superiority. No less curiously, Acheulean tools are found in the Middle East well over 1 million years ago, but scarcely exist in Europe until just 300,000 years ago. Again, why people who had the technology didn't take the tools with them is a mystery. For a long time, it was believed that the Cro-Magnons, as modern humans in Europe became known, drove the Neanderthals before them as they advanced across the continent, eventually forcing them to its western margins, where essentially they had no choice but to fall in the sea or go extinct. In fact, it is now known that Cro-Magnons were in the far west of Europe at about the same time they were also coming in from the east. Europe was a pretty empty place in those days, Tattersall says. They may not have encountered each other all that often, even with all their comings and goings. One curiosity of the Cro-Magnon's arrival is that it came at a time known to paleoclimatology as the Bouteiller interval, when Europe was plunging from a period of relative mildness into yet another long spell of punishing cold. Whatever it was that drew them to Europe, it wasn't the glorious weather. In any case, the idea that Neanderthals crumpled in the face of competition from newly arrived Cro-Magnons strains against the evidence at least a little. Neanderthals were nothing if not tough. For tens of thousands of years they lived through conditions that no modern human outside a few polar scientists and explorers has experienced. During the worst of the ice ages, blizzards with hurricane-force winds were common. Temperatures routinely fell to 50 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Polar bears padded across the snowy vales of southern England. Neanderthals naturally retreated from the worst of it, but even so they will have experienced weather that was at least as bad as a modern Siberian winter. They suffered, to be sure. A Neanderthal who lived much past 30 was lucky indeed, but as a species they were magnificently resilient and practically indestructible. They survived for at least 100,000 years, and perhaps twice that, over an area stretching from Gibraltar to Uzbekistan, which is a pretty successful run for any species of being. Quite who they were and what they were like remain matters of disagreement and uncertainty. Right up until the middle of the 20th century, the accepted anthropological view of the Neanderthal was that he was dim, stooped, shuffling, and simian, the quintessential caveman. It was only a painful accident that prodded scientists to reconsider this view. In 1947, while doing fieldwork in the Sahara, a Franco-Algerian paleontologist named Camille Arambourg took refuge from the midday sun under the wing of his light airplane. As he sat there, a tire burst from the heat and the plane tipped, suddenly, striking him a painful blow on the upper body. Later, in Paris, he went for an X-ray of his neck, and noticed that his own vertebrae were aligned exactly like those of a stooped and hulking Neanderthal. Either he was physiologically primitive, or Neanderthal's posture had been misdescribed. In fact, it was the latter. Neanderthal vertebrae were not simian at all. It changed utterly how we viewed Neanderthals. But only some of the time, it appears. It is still commonly held that Neanderthals lacked the intelligence or fibre to compete on equal terms with the continent's slender and more cerebrally nimble newcomers, Homo sapiens. Here is a typical comment from a recent book. Modern humans neutralized this advantage, the Neanderthals' considerably heartier physique, with better clothing, better fires, and better shelter. Meanwhile, the Neanderthals were stuck with an oversized body that required more food to sustain. In other words, the very factors that had allowed them to survive successfully for 100,000 years suddenly became an insuperable handicap. Above all, the issue that is almost never addressed is that Neanderthals had brains that were significantly larger than those of modern people. 1.8 liters for Neanderthals versus 1.4 for modern people, according to one calculation. This is more than the difference between modern Homo sapiens and the late Homo erectus, a species we are happy to regard as barely human. The argument put forward is that although our brains were smaller, they were somehow more efficient. I believe I speak the truth when I observe that nowhere else in human evolution is such an argument made. So why, then, you may well ask, if the Neanderthals were so stout and adaptable and cerebrally well endowed, are they no longer with us? One possible but much disputed answer is that perhaps they are. Alan Thorne is one of the leading proponents of an alternative theory known as the multi-regional hypothesis, which holds that human evolution has been continuous, that just as Australopithecines evolved into Homo habilis and Homo heidelbergensis became over time Homo neanderthalensis, so modern Homo sapiens simply emerged from more ancient Homo forms. Homo erectus is, on this view, not a separate species, but just a transitional phase. Thus, modern Chinese are descended from ancient Homo erectus forebears in China, modern Europeans from ancient European Homo erectus, and so on. Except that for me there are no Homo erectus, says Thorne. I think it's a term which has outlived its usefulness. For me, Homo erectus is simply an earlier part of us. I believe only one species of humans has ever left Africa, and that species is Homo sapiens. Opponents of the multi-regional theory reject it, in the first instance, on the grounds that it requires an improbable amount of parallel evolution by hominids throughout the Old World, in Africa, China, Europe, the most distant islands of Indonesia, wherever they appeared. Some also believe that multi-regionalism encourages a racist view that anthropology took a very long time to rid itself of. In the early 1960s, a famous anthropologist named Carlton Kuhn of the University of Pennsylvania suggested that some modern races have different sources of origin, implying that some of us come from more superior stock than others. This harkened back, uncomfortably, to earlier beliefs that some modern races, such as the African Bushmen, properly the Kalahari San, and Australian Aborigines, were more primitive than others. Whatever Kuhn may personally have felt, the implication for many people was that some races are inherently more advanced, and that some humans could essentially constitute different species. The view, so instinctively offensive now, was widely popularized in many respectable places until fairly recent times. I have before me a popular book published by Time Life Publications in 1961 called The Epic of Man, based on a series of articles in Life magazine. In it you can find such comments as, "Rhodesian man lived as recently as 25,000 years ago, and may have been an ancestor of the African Negroes. His brain size was close to that of Homo sapiens." In other words, black Africans were recently descended from creatures that were only close to Homo sapiens. Thorne emphatically, and I believe sincerely, dismisses the idea that his theory is in any measure racist, and accounts for the uniformity of human evolution by suggesting that there was a lot of movement back and forth between cultures and religions. "There's no reason to suppose that people only went in one direction," he says. "People were moving all over the place, and where they met, they almost certainly shared genetic material through interbreeding. New arrivals didn't replace the indigenous populations, they joined them, they became them." He likens the situation to when explorers like Cook or Magellan encountered remote peoples for the first time. They weren't meetings of different species, but of the same species with some physical differences. "What you actually see in the fossil record," Thorne insists, "is a smooth, continuous transition. There's a famous skull from Petralona in Greece, dating from about 300,000 years ago, that has been a matter of contention among traditionalists, because it seems in some ways Homo erectus, but in other ways Homo sapiens. Well, what we say is that this is just what you would expect to find in species that were evolving rather than being displaced." One thing that would help to resolve matters would be evidence of interbreeding, but that is not at all easy to prove or disprove from fossils. In 1999, archaeologists in Portugal found the skeleton of a child about 4 years old that died 24,500 years ago. The skeleton was modern overall, but with certain archaic, possibly Neanderthal, characteristics. Unusually sturdy leg bones, teeth bearing a distinctive shoveling pattern, and, though not everyone agrees on it, an indentation at the back of the skull called a supraniac fossa, a feature exclusive to Neanderthals. Eric Trinkaus of Washington University in St. Louis, the leading authority on Neanderthals, announced the child to be a hybrid, proof that modern humans and Neanderthals interbred. Others, however, were troubled that the Neanderthal and modern features weren't more blended. As one critic put it, "If you look at a mule, you don't have the front end looking like a donkey and the back end looking like a horse." Ian Tattersall declared it to be nothing more than a chunky modern child. He accepts that there may well have been some hanky-panky between Neanderthals and moderns, but doesn't believe it could have resulted in reproductively successful offspring. "I don't know of any two organisms from any realm of biology that are that different and still in the same species," he says. One possibility is that Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons had different numbers of chromosomes, a complication that commonly arises when species that are close but not quite identical conjoin. In the equine world, for example, horses have 64 chromosomes and donkeys 62. Mate the two and you get an offspring with a reproductively useless number of chromosomes, 63. You have, in short, a sterile mule. With the fossil record so unhelpful, scientists have turned increasingly to genetic studies, in particular the part known as mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA was only discovered in 1964, but by the 1980s, some ingenious souls at the University of California at Berkeley had realized that it has two features that lend it a particular convenience as a kind of molecular clock. It is passed on only through the female line, so it doesn't become scrambled with paternal DNA with each new generation, and it mutates about 20 times faster than normal nuclear DNA, making it easier to detect and follow genetic patterns over time. By tracking the rates of mutation, they could work out the genetic history and relationships of whole groups of people. In 1987, the Berkeley team, led by the late Alan Wilson, did an analysis of mitochondrial DNA from 147 individuals and declared that the rise of anatomically modern humans occurred in Africa within the last 140,000 years, and that all present-day humans are descended from that population. It was a serious blow to the multi-regionalists. But then people began to look a little more closely at the data. One of the most extraordinary points, almost too extraordinary to credit, really, was that the Africans used in the study were actually African Americans, whose genes had obviously been subjected to considerable mediation in the past few hundred years. Doubts also soon emerged about the assumed rates of mutations. By 1992, the study was largely discredited. But the techniques of genetic analysis continued to be refined, and in 1997, scientists from the University of Munich managed to extract and analyze some DNA from the arm bone of the original Neanderthal man, and this time the evidence stood up. The Munich study found that the Neanderthal DNA was unlike any DNA found on Earth now, strongly indicating that there was no genetic connection between Neanderthals and modern humans. Now this really was a blow to multi-regionalism. Then in late 2000, Nature and other publications reported on a Swedish study of the mitochondrial DNA of 53 people, which suggested that all modern humans emerged from Africa within the past 100,000 years and came from a breeding stock of no more than 10,000 individuals. Soon afterward, Eric Lander, director of the Whitehead Institute, Massachusetts Institute of Technology Center for Genome Research, announced that modern Europeans, and perhaps people farther afield, are descended from no more than a few hundred Africans who left their homeland as recently as 25,000 years ago. As we have noted elsewhere in the book, modern human beings show remarkably little genetic variability. There's more diversity in one social group of 55 chimps than in the entire human population, as one authority has put it. And this would explain why. Because we are recently descended from a small founding population, there hasn't been time enough or people enough to provide a source of great variability. It seemed a pretty severe blow to multi-regionalism. After this, a Penn State academic told the Washington Post, people won't be too concerned about the multi-regional theory, which has very little evidence. But all of this overlooked the more or less infinite capacity for surprise offered by the ancient Mungo people of western New South Wales. In early 2001, Thorne and his colleagues at the Australian National University reported that they had recovered DNA from the oldest of the Mungo specimens, now dated at 62,000 years, and that this DNA proved to be genetically distinct. The Mungo man, according to these findings, was anatomically modern, just like you and me, but carried an extinct genetic lineage. His mitochondrial DNA is no longer found in living humans, as it should be if, like all other modern people, he was descended from people who left Africa in the recent past. It turned everything upside down again, says Thorne, with undisguised delight. Then other even more curious anomalies began to turn up. Rosalind Harding, a population geneticist at the Institute of Biological Anthropology in Oxford, while studying beta-globin genes in modern people, found two variants that are common among Asians and the indigenous people of Australia, but hardly exist in Africa. The variant genes, she is certain, arose more than 200,000 years ago, not in Africa, but in East Asia, long before modern Homo sapiens reached the region. The only way to account for them is to say that ancestors of people now living in Asia included archaic hominids, Java man and the like. Interestingly, this same variant gene, the Java man gene, so to speak, turns up in modern populations in Oxfordshire. Confused, I went to see Harding at the Institute, which inhabits an old brick villa on Banbury Road in Oxford, in more or less the neighbourhood where Bill Clinton spent his student days. Harding is a small and chirpy Australian from Brisbane, originally, with a rare knack for being amused and earnest at the same time. "Don't know," she said at once, grinning, when I asked her how people in Oxfordshire harboured sequences of beta-globin that shouldn't be there. "On the whole," she went on more somberly, "the genetic record supports the out-of-Africa hypothesis. But then you find these anomalous clusters, which most geneticists prefer not to talk about. There's huge amounts of information that would be available to us if only we could understand it. But we don't yet. We've barely begun." She refused to be drawn out on what the existence of Asian origin genes in Oxfordshire tells us, other than that the situation is clearly complicated. All we can say at this stage is that it is very untidy, and we don't really know why. At the time of our meeting in early 2002, another Oxford scientist named Brian Sykes had just produced a popular book called The Seven Daughters of Eve, in which, using studies of mitochondrial DNA, he had claimed to be able to trace nearly all living Europeans back to a founding population of just seven women, the Daughters of Eve of the title, who lived between 10,000 and 45,000 years ago in the time known to science as the Paleolithic. To each of these women Sykes had given a name, Ursula, Xenia, Jasmine, and so on, and even a detailed personal history. Ursula was her mother's second child. The first had been taken by a leopard when he was only two. When I asked Harding about the book, she smiled broadly but carefully, as if not quite certain where to go with her answer. "Well, I suppose you must give him some credit for helping to popularize a difficult subject," she said, and paused thoughtfully. "And there remains the remote possibility that he's right." She laughed, then went on more intently. "Data from any single gene cannot really tell you anything so definitive. If you follow the mitochondrial DNA backwards, it will take you to a certain place, to an Ursula, or Tara, or whatever. But if you take any other bit of DNA, any gene at all, and trace it back, it will take you someplace else altogether." It was a little, I gathered, like following a road randomly out of London, and finding that eventually it ends at John O'Groats, and concluding from this that anyone in London must therefore have come from the north of Scotland. They might have come from there, of course, but equally they could have arrived from any of hundreds of other places. In this sense, according to Harding, every gene is a different highway, and we have only barely begun to map the routes. "No single gene is ever going to tell you the whole story," she said. "So genetic studies aren't to be trusted?" "Oh, you can trust the studies well enough, generally speaking. What you can't trust are the sweeping conclusions that people often attach to them." She thinks out of Africa is probably 95% correct, but adds, "I think both sides have done a bit of a disservice to science by insisting that it must be one thing or the other. Things are likely to turn out to be not so straightforward as either camp would have you believe. The evidence is clearly starting to suggest that there were multiple migrations and dispersals in different parts of the world going on in all kinds of directions, and generally mixing up the gene pool. That's never going to be easy to sort out." Just at this time, there were also a number of reports questioning the reliability of claims concerning the recovery of very ancient DNA. An academic writing in Nature had noted how a paleontologist, asked by a colleague whether he thought an old skull was varnished or not, had licked its top and announced that it was. In the process, noted the Nature article, large amounts of modern human DNA would have been transferred to the skull, rendering it useless for future study. I asked Harding about this. "Oh, it would almost certainly have been contaminated already," she said. "Just handling a bone will contaminate it. Breathing on it will contaminate it. Most of the water in our labs will contaminate it. We are all swimming in foreign DNA. In order to get a reliably clean specimen, you have to excavate it in sterile conditions and do the tests on it at the site. It is the trickiest thing in the world not to contaminate a specimen." "So should such claims be treated dubiously?" I asked. Harding nodded solemnly. "Very," she said. If you wish to understand at once why we know as little as we do about human origins, I have the place for you. It is to be found a little beyond the edge of the Blue Ngong Hills in Kenya, to the south and west of Nairobi. Drive out of the city on the main highway to Uganda, and there comes a moment of startling glory when the ground falls away and you are presented with a hang glider's view of boundless, pale-green African plain. This is the Great Rift Valley, which arcs across 3,000 miles of East Africa, marking the tectonic rupture that is setting Africa adrift from Asia. Here, perhaps 40 miles out of Nairobi, along the baking valley floor, is an ancient site called Ologosele, which once stood beside a large and pleasant lake. In 1919, long after the lake had vanished, a geologist named J.W. Gregory was scouting the area for mineral prospects when he came across a stretch of open ground littered with anomalous dark stones that had clearly been shaped by human hand. He had found one of the great sites of a Sherlian tool manufacture that Ian Tattersall had told me about. Unexpectedly, in the autumn of 2002, I found myself a visitor to this extraordinary site. I was in Kenya for another purpose altogether, visiting some projects run by the charity Care International, but my hosts, knowing of my interest in humans for the present volume, had inserted a visit to Ologosele into the schedule. After its discovery by Gregory, Ologosele lay undisturbed for over two decades, before the famed husband and wife team of Lewis and Mary Leakey began an excavation that isn't completed yet. What the Leakeys found was a site stretching to 10 acres or so, where tools were made in incalculable numbers for roughly 1 million years, from about 1.2 million years ago to 200,000 years ago. Today the tool beds are sheltered from the worst of the elements beneath large tin lean-tos, and fenced off with chicken wire to discourage opportunistic scavenging by visitors, but otherwise the tools are left just where their creators dropped them, and where the Leakeys found them. Jilani Ngali, a keen young man from the Kenyan National Museum who'd been dispatched to act as guide, told me that the quartz and obsidian rocks from which the axes were made were never found on the valley floor. They had to carry the stones from there, he said, nodding at a pair of mountains in the hazy middle distance in opposite directions from the site, Ologosele and Ol Esakut. Each was about 10 kilometers or 6 miles away. A long way to carry an armload of stone. Why the early Ologosele people went to such trouble we can only guess, of course. Not only did they lug hefty stones considerable distances to the lakeside, but, perhaps even more remarkably, they then organized the site. The Leakey's excavations revealed that there were areas where axes were fashioned, and others where blunt axes were brought to be resharpened. Ologosele was, in short, a kind of factory, one that stayed in business for 1 million years. Various replications have shown that the axes were tricky and labour-intensive objects to make. Even with practice, an axe would take hours to fashion, and yet, curiously, they were not particularly good for cutting, or chopping, or scraping, or any of the other tasks to which they were presumably put. So we are left with the position that for 1 million years, far, far longer than our own species has even been in existence, much less engaged in continuous cooperative efforts, early people came in considerable numbers to this particular site to make extravagantly large numbers of tools that appear to have been rather curiously pointless. And who were these people? We have no idea, actually. We assume they were Homo erectus because there are no other known candidates, which means that at their peak, the Ologosele workers would have had the brains of a modern infant. But there is no physical evidence on which to base a conclusion. Despite over 60 years of searching, no human bone has ever been found in or around the vicinity of Ologosele. However much time they spent there shaping rocks, it appears they went elsewhere to die. "It's all a mystery," Jelani Ngali told me, beaming happily. The Ologosele people disappeared from the scene about 200,000 years ago, when the lake dried up and the Rift Valley started to become the hot and challenging place it is today. But by this time their days as a species were already numbered. The world was about to get its first real master race, Homo sapiens. Things would never be the same again. 30. Goodbye. In the early 1680s, At just about the time that Edmund Halley and his friends Christopher Wren and Robert Hooke were settling down in a London coffee house and embarking on the casual wager that would result eventually in Isaac Newton's Principia, Henry Cavendish's Weighing of the Earth, and many of the other inspired and commendable undertakings that have occupied us for much of the past 400 pages, a rather less desirable milestone was being passed on the island of Mauritius, far out in the Indian Ocean, some 800 miles off the east coast of Madagascar. There, some forgotten sailor or sailor's pet was harrying to death the last of the dodos, the famously flightless bird whose dim but trusting nature and lack of leggy zip made it a rather irresistible target for bored young tars on shore leave. Millions of years of peaceful isolation had not prepared it for the erratic and deeply unnerving behaviour of human beings. We don't know precisely the circumstances, or even year attending the last moments of the last dodo, so we don't know which arrived first, a world that contained a Principia, or one that had no dodos, but we do know that they happened at more or less the same time. You would be hard-pressed, I would submit, to find a better pairing of occurrences to illustrate the divine and felonious nature of the human being, a species of organism that is capable of unpicking the deepest secrets of the heavens, while at the same time pounding into extinction, for no purpose at all, a creature that never did us any harm and wasn't even remotely capable of understanding what we were doing to it as we did it. Indeed, dodos were so spectacularly short on insight, it is reported, that if you wished to find all the dodos in a vicinity, you had only to catch one and set it to squawking, and all the others would waddle along to see what was up. The indignities to the poor dodo didn't end quite there. In 1755, some 70 years after the last dodo's death, the director of the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford decided that the institution's stuffed dodo was becoming unpleasantly musty, and ordered it tossed on a bonfire. This was a surprising decision, as it was by this time the only dodo in existence, stuffed or otherwise. A passing employee, aghast, tried to rescue the bird, but could save only its head and part of one limb. As a result of this, and other departures from common sense, we are not now entirely sure what a living dodo was like. We possess much less information than most people suppose, a handful of crude descriptions by unscientific voyagers, 3 or 4 oil paintings, and a few scattered osseous fragments, in the somewhat aggrieved words of the 19th-century naturalist H. E. Strickland. As Strickland wistfully observed, we have more physical evidence of some ancient sea monsters and lumbering sauropods than we do of a bird that lived into modern times and required nothing of us to survive except our absence. So what is known of the dodo is this. It lived on Mauritius. It was plump, but not tasty, and was the biggest ever member of the pigeon family, though by quite what margin is unknown, as its weight was never accurately recorded. Extrapolations from Strickland's osseous fragments and the Ashmolean's modest remains show that it was a little over 2.5 feet tall, and about the same distance from beak tip to backside. Being flightless, it nested on the ground, leaving its eggs and chicks tragically easy prey for pigs, dogs, and monkeys brought to the island by outsiders. It was probably extinct by 1683, and was most certainly gone by 1693. Beyond that, we know almost nothing, except, of course, that we will not see its like again. We know nothing of its reproductive habits and diet, where it ranged, what sounds it made in tranquillity or alarm. We don't possess a single dodo egg. From beginning to end, our acquaintance with animate dodos lasted just 70 years. That is a breathtakingly scanty period, though it must be said that by this point in our history we did have thousands of years of practice behind us in the matter of irreversible eliminations. Nobody knows quite how destructive human beings are, but it is a fact that over the last 50,000 years or so, wherever we have gone, animals have tended to vanish, in often astonishingly large numbers. In America, 30 genera of large animals, some very large indeed, disappeared practically at a stroke after the arrival of modern humans on the continent between 10,000 and 20,000 years ago. Altogether, North and South America between them lost about 3/4 of their big animals once man the hunter arrived with his flint-headed spears and keen organizational capabilities. Europe and Asia, where the animals had had longer to evolve a useful wariness of humans, lost between a third and a half of their big creatures. Australia, for exactly the opposite reasons, lost no less than 95%. Because the early hunter populations were comparatively small, and the animal populations truly monumental, as many as 10 million mammoth carcasses are thought to lie frozen in the tundra of northern Siberia alone, some authorities think there must be other explanations, possibly involving climate change or some kind of pandemic. As Ross McPhee of the American Museum of Natural History put it, "There is no material benefit to hunting dangerous animals more often than you need to. There are only so many mammoth steaks you can eat." Others believe it may have been almost criminally easy to catch and clobber prey. "In Australia and the Americas," says Tim Flannery,